For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host Red Sale, and this week, CJ Skews reveals why girl next door serial killer Rhiannon Lewis is feeling all at sea in her latest novel, Deadhead. Costa winner Monique Roffey reveals which books have most resonated with her as a writer. Robert Kirkwood looks back on the day that the creator of The Gruffalo, Julia Donaldson, visited the RNIB Talking Book Studios. And we celebrate LGBTQ plus History Month by reviewing the short story that became the Oscar-winning film Brokeback Mountain. That's all coming up in today's Read On. Deadhead is the third book in the best-selling Sweet Pea series by CJ Skews, and finds girl-next-door serial killer Rhiannon Lewis pondering whether she has lost her taste for murder. If you haven't already come across the series, think Bridget Jones Diary meets American Psycho in Bristol. Darkly funny and very bloody, Deadhead finds Rhiannon all at sea, as CJ explained to me when she joined me down the line from Bath. And a warning, some of the topics that we discuss may be upsetting to young ears. CJ, welcome to Read On.
Hello, thank you for having me.
So I've been following Rhiannon's checkered and bloody career through the first two books, Sweet Pea and In Bloom, and anyone who thought that she was going to be changing tack is probably in for a unpleasant surprise.
Yeah, there's no changing Rhiannon, really. She is what she is. So if you didn't like her in the first book, chances are you're not going to like her very much in books two or three either. She's a dyed-in-the-wool serial killer, and there's no changing her.
You really don't want to get on the wrong side of her, do you?
You don't, no. She has a very strict moral code, and she does change to an extent, but she still has this bloodlust and this predilection for taking out certain members of society who the justice system doesn't seem to catch up with.
She's a complex character. There's a reason why she is a serial killer.
Yeah, I mean, it's for the reader to make up their own mind as to why she is the way she is. But I think there's a few reasons that could help to explain why she likes killing and why she feels she has to. And some of it comes from her own childhood. Some of it comes from her own father, who didn't exactly discourage her from having a bloodlust for doing these things. So it doesn't really excuse what she does, but it certainly contributes to explaining why she's taken to doing this in later life. Yeah.
Anybody who hasn't yet come across the series might wonder why we are talking somewhat sympathetically about somebody who goes around killing people, but she is a victim as well as a perpetrator.
Yeah, I wanted to create a character who does abhorrent things, but there is a sort of explanation as to why she does these awful things, in the same kind of way that there is with Dexter, who's the Jeff Lindsay serial killer created for the American market. She was the victim of a traumatic event when she was 6 years old, where a guy broke into her daycare setting and killed all the children apart from Rhiannon, and it was a vendetta against his ex-wife. So she was just caught up in this, and it became a famous event, and as a result of that she was slightly brain damaged. So again, it doesn't excuse what she does in later life, but it does explain that, you know, since that point her brain has been wired in a different way, which could help explain why she's taken to doing these monstrous things in later life.
And there's certainly a degree of arrested development there. Part of her is still trapped in that six-year-old self. She likes to collect Sylvanian families. I always get the impression that she would rather like to be part of a perfect family. It's just, it's been wrecked for her.
Yeah, that's absolutely it. You've hit it right on the head there. She sort of did stop, a part of her stopped developing at 6 years old. And there's almost like this slightly sentimental thing with her, that she is still six in some ways. She is still this little girl who was just overtaken by life events and hasn't really processed it very well. And of course, the thing that happened to her was so macabre and so traumatic and bloody that there's, I kind of, in my head, I explain it as this child who was faced with a monstrously adult thing happening. And everything was drenched in blood when she woke up, literally. So there's this odd mashup of childhood and violence and gore. And that is who she is as an adult. She's just become this very strange oddity who doesn't quite process life in the same way as everybody else. It is this odd thing of she collects Sylvanian families and she dreams of living in almost like Sylvanian families' land, where everything's great as long as you're baking cakes and you're happy and you're settled and you have your family all around you. But actually life isn't like that for Rhiannon, and she just doesn't quite fit in with anyone, and she doesn't meet anyone who fits in with her either.
Now, that's the chilling side of Rhiannon. She is also very funny, and she gets to say the things that I suspect you and I know I would like to say to people when they're rude or unpleasant to me. She gets that dig and sometimes a knife in.
Oh, yeah, she does. Yeah, absolutely. And I think if all bets were off, she would say and do whatever she wanted. So it's probably a good thing that they're not off and she doesn't get to kill. Because if she wanted to kill everyone that she wanted to kill, there'd be no one left and she'd be in prison. But yeah, she does say some pretty horrendous things. And a lot of the comments I get are from people who they wanted to hate her, but they found themselves laughing with her and laughing at the things that she says. And as you say, you know, a lot of people want to say those things, but find themselves too socially aware, I guess. But yeah, she is funny. And I think a lot of people forgive her for the things she does because she's funny.
Do a lot of those situations actually come from your own personal experience when you get cut up on the way to work or when somebody walks into you, spills your coffee and doesn't apologise?
Yeah, of course. And I think they happen to everybody. And it's not like big life events. It's just things like if you get passed up for a promotion or you get made redundant from a job that you loved and you felt you should have progressed in. It's sort of comparatively little things like that. And right down to the tiny things like you're in a supermarket and you want to get to the tuna and there's some bloke stood in the way who seems to have no spatial awareness. It's the big things right down to the little things that irritate her. And I've tried to get as many of those things into the book because everybody experiences them. At the moment, we're all experiencing them when we're allowed to go out. We can't cross a road without somebody tearing past and trying to knock us down, or we can't walk down the road without some jogger huffing and puffing all over us, which I'm finding at the moment especially irritating. I think this situation has brought out the best and worst of people, but that's human nature, isn't it? You know, we were all put on this earth to delight and destroy each other.
Well, I did find myself thinking, oh, I should be keeping a diary and creating my own Rhiannon for all those little slights that we constantly have. You must find it incredibly cathartic.
Oh, so cathartic. I mean, every time I delve into Rhiannon's world, it's like taking off a straitjacket. I can say and do what I want. And I was writing young adult fiction for 6 years before I started the Sweet Pea books. And there was many, many things I wanted to do and say in YA, which I just couldn't, because you're not really supposed to swear very much in YA and you're not really supposed to do many naughty things. I won't go into details. I'll leave that to your imagination. But when I was writing Sweet Pea, I was given free rein and it was like my editor just said, yeah, go for it. She can say that. She can do that. So Rhiannon is incredibly freeing. I think we all need our own diary of Rhiannonisms, definitely.
And you are clearly not the only person who enjoys inhabiting Rhiannon. Your narrator, Georgia Maguire, is obviously having a ball while she's reading the books.
She absolutely is, and she's nailed it. She's completely nailed the voice and the sarcastic tone. Yeah, she's brilliant.
We're on the mezzanine. 20 lines of chairs in the endless biographies section. A standing room only. I'm at the back, facing the aisle between a woman with a bulky handbag and a MAGA-capped Hulk Hogan lookalike with more earrings than actual ear. At the front, behind two vacant stools and mic stands, is a huge poster of the book cover with my face on. The Sweet Pea Killer. The True Confessions of Rhiannon Lewis. They've gone to town on decorations. Paper lay garlands draped over bookshelves. Fake roses dangling from jutting Barbara Streisand memoirs. Fake petals scattered around the carpet. Everyone on seats or standing is carrying a copy of the book. My book. Wow, 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 fellas. Look at the old girl now, fellas. They're giving out ice biscuits too. Flower-shaped. Nice touch. Tray is empty by the time it gets to me, of course. Typical. God forbid someone nips out the back to open another packet and refill it. I spent the best part of my 20s trying to get a book deal. And now I have a best-selling book out with my face on the cover and my story within the pages. And it's been at the top of the non-fiction bestseller lists for the last 4 months. The only problem is, I can take none of the credit. No glow radiates on me.
Georgia McGuire narrating Deadhead, the latest book in the Sweet Pea series, written by my guest, CJ Skews. Now, it's fantastic news that the Sweet Pea series and many of your other books have been turned into audiobooks. And I believe that there's a family connection to the RNIB Talking Books Library as well.
Yes, my dad, who is no longer with us, sadly, but he used to mend talking books for the blind many, many moons ago. And I don't know very much about it, but I seem to recall there was always one or two lying about the house that he was mending. And I think he used to like listening to the books as well. So I don't think it was completely unselfish. But yeah, I don't know how he got involved in it. And I can't find any literature. I've torn apart my garage looking for a certificate that the RNIB sent him at the end of his service. But he did it for years, decades. He would go around collecting people's talking book machines and mending them because he was a radio engineer. He used to mend TVs and radios. That was his trade before he went into the pub trade. And I don't know how he got involved in it, but he would mend the talking books for the blind and then just deliver them back to people's houses in the local area.
Well, I'm sure there are many people in the Weston-super-Mare area who probably remember him and will be very, very grateful for him having reconnected their link to the outside world.
Absolutely, yeah. He used to really enjoy mending them.
So, CJ, Deadhead finds Rhiannon all at sea on a cruise liner, hopefully escaping Britain, after having been identified as a serial killer, but it's not plain sailing.
No, of course not. So, yeah, when we last met Rhiannon at the end of In Bloom, which was the second book, she just had a baby and she'd left the baby behind. So a bit of a spoiler there, but if you've read the books and you're waiting for Deadhead, that's what you'll already know. And yes, she does leave the UK. She gets on a cruise ship. And she, without giving too much away, she has an idea of where she's going next. She has a sanctuary that she's already heading towards. But of course, things go wrong. Things don't go the way she's planned. And she has to make other arrangements. So all her plans are up in the air in Deadhead. And apart from that, the other big problem in Deadhead is that she has lost the will to kill. She doesn't actually feel that same need. And it's all because of the baby. She's given up this baby because she thought, this is what I need to do. This is for her own good. But she finds she actually misses her. And she's undergoing some kind of postnatal depression or postnatal abandonment issues. Goodness knows what's going on in her head, but she's feeling it. And killing is the last thing on her mind.
And yet she is surrounded by tempting targets. You paint such a wonderful picture of the claustrophobia of being stuck with dreadful people on a floating tin can.
Yeah. Well, I actually went on a little cruise with my sister at the end of 2019, about September 2019, and I just wrote down, I knew what was going to happen with Rhiannon then, and I just wrote down everything I saw and heard and was irritated by on this cruise. And it was just reams and reams of people just being the worst kind of people. So it's all there. It's all kind of from real life, really.
Where did Rhiannon come from?
She came from a lot of years of very little rejections, a lot of being dumped, being passed over for job opportunities and things like that. That's where the humour comes from, because I very much, when something happens, I just kind of laugh it off and make light of it. But she actually came from two different places, which are quite odd. But one was an advert on TV for the TV series, the Gillian Anderson one with Jamie Dornan. The advert was her stalking him. She was a police detective and he was a serial killer. But I saw this advert and I thought, oh, why aren't there more things about women who stalk men? You know, all the crime dramas that we see, for the most part, are the victims are women and men are the predators. And I just wanted to write one thing where a woman was the predator. So I had that in my mind already. And the second place it came from was online. I saw this picture of the meme called Serial Killer Barbie, and it's the Barbie doll who is in a series of these very horrible frescoes where she's killed Ken and she's got his head on a plate, or she's got him dismembered in the bathtub. They're horrible, horrible pictures, but they're in kind of juvenile Barbie and Ken form. So it looks like a very picturesque Barbie and Ken scene. But actually, if you look closer, there's like a dismembered hand on the table and the dog's eating a leg on the floor. It's awful. But both these things started mixing ideas in my head where I thought, oh, I could do something here. There's a character trying to get out here, a predatory woman who has this penchant for children's toys.
And you teach creative writing down at Bath Spa University as your day job. Do you find that your students approach you differently now that you're a best-selling author?
No, not at all. Not at all. I try and keep the two me's as separate as possible. Obviously, I apply my own, what I've learned from being published and from writing. Obviously, I apply that to the course, but I do try and keep the two things as separate as possible, because I actually lecture in writing for young people. So I'm sort of talking with my YA head on again when I'm with my students. So I'm just trying to help them navigate the publishing industry in the best possible way, and talking about the pitfalls and the things I've learned from being published that I want them to be aware of now, so that they're armed with that knowledge when they enter the industry. So yeah, I'm trying to be as encouraging as I can while also giving them the best tools possible so that they can have a good career ahead of them.
So in many ways, would you say that your teaching style is actually to show the more negative side of wanting to become an author than promote the positive sides?
Sometimes I can be the bad fairy at the feast, because I teach a module called Contemporary Children's Publishing. But I try not to be negative. I try and be as positive as possible, but I'm certainly not going to sit there and lie to them. I'm not going to say you're going to make a bestseller out of your first book. That's absolutely 100% going to happen. And you're never going to have rejection again as soon as you get your first book deal. I'm certainly not going to be there saying this to them, because it's just not true. And I want them to remember what I say when they are publishing their books, or when they're getting Waterstones Book of the Month, or when they sign with an agent. I just want them to remember some of the advice that I have for them, because it's all based in experiences I've had. And I had a very sugar-coated view of the industry when I entered it. I really thought my first book would be a massive bestseller and I wouldn't have to write 100 other books to try and get to that point. I didn't realize how long things took as well when I entered the industry. I thought a film deal would come with book one. It actually came with book six. I thought rejection was a thing of the past, when actually it's just another level of rejection, because you get to be rejected by whole countries who don't want to publish you, and film companies who don't want to make films of your books. And I didn't have a clue about any of that. I really thought all of this would happen with book one. So it's a tough industry, especially for artists, who your books are your babies. They really are. So when you're putting your baby on the slab and saying, here, have it, do what you want with it, it's like you've really got to trust your publisher and your agent, and you've got to trust your own ability as well. And you've got to grow a very, very thick skin, because when you get a lot of people saying nasty things about you on Amazon reviews and Goodreads reviews, it hurts. And you've got to learn that that's coming and it's unavoidable. So I learned quite early on to stop Googling myself, because therein only bad things will come.
And I am guessing that your advice is always to write a little every day and just to chip away at the mountain that 100,000 words seems to present at the beginning of the journey.
It's not to write every day, because particularly at the moment, I think a lot of people are finding it hard to do anything other than just survive and live. And so I wouldn't ever say to somebody, you have to write every day, you have to read every day. But I do spout a quote that Dick Strawbridge talks about. Dick Strawbridge is the engineer who lives in France now, and he stars in Escape to the Chateau on Channel 4, which is one of my favourite programmes. And he always talks about biting the elephant, which is, don't look at the whole project and think, oh my God, I've got to write a 300 odd page book. I've got to get all these subplots in. You know, if you think about how big a task is or how big a project is, you catastrophize and then it all comes crumbling down on you because you just think, I can't do it. But you're absolutely right. Taking it a little piece at a time, even if some days you just look at the screen and think, OK, I don't know what to do, but I'm going to change the name of my main character. That will be enough for today. So as long as you're pushing that envelope a little bit at a time, if you can write 1,000 words a day, when I'm on a deadline, I try and do 1,000 words a day, even if they're rubbish words, because hopefully there'll be one line in there that is really, really good and helps me bite the elephant a little bit more. So a little bit at a time is definitely the way to write a book. It's certainly the way I wrote Deadhead, because that was like pushing a pea up a mountain with my nose. You'd think it would be easy after three books about the same character, but it was definitely the most challenging because it wasn't set in the UK and I had to do a bit of research and I had to, go way outside my comfort zone for this one.
Without challenging you and saying it was definitely the most difficult so far, how is Rhiannon going to cope with lockdown?
Actually, lockdown, I'm kind of thinking about book four at the moment in my head. I'm not contracted to write it, but she's always in my mind. So I'm always thinking, how is she coping with things like this? And actually, lockdown is working out really well for Rhiannon. One of the lines I've come up with is COVID-19 has done wonders for my image. And it's because, of course, everybody is talking about COVID. Everyone is affected by COVID. So things like a serial killer is knocked right off the front pages. So where initially at the end of In Bloom, she wanted to be famous, she wanted to be loved for being a serial killer. By the end of Deadhead, she wants to hide again. She's found a reason to be undercover. And it comes just at the point that COVID starts hitting America and the UK. So it's actually working out really well for her.
Well, I, for one, will be fascinated to see how she continues in this changed world. But in the meantime, CJ Skews, thank you so much for taking us further into the twisted and bloody world of Rhiannon Lewis and for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you very much for having me.
And CJ Skews will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
We know that for many parents, homeschooling can be challenging. RNIB's Children, Young People and Families team is available to help families and professionals who are supporting children through the pandemic and current lockdown. You can contact our support officers for individual advice or help, or join one of our online events to connect with other teachers or parents. Call us on the RNIB helpline, which is 0303 123 9999, or email cypf@rnib.org.uk. You can also get full details of how we can help at rnib.org.uk/children.
You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. Still to come, we've got a treat for all the younger children who are studying from home, as Julia Donaldson works some magic to turn her story Freddy the Fairy into a talking book. But first, a couple of weeks ago, Monique Roffey won the 2020 Costa Book of the Year Award for her beguiling novel, The Mermaid of Black Conch. I caught up with her shortly afterwards, eager to discover which books have resonated with her as an author. Monique, congratulations.
Thank you so much, Red.
Sunk in yet?
It's going to take some time to sink in, I think, over the next few days and maybe a few weeks. Yeah, no, it hasn't yet.
Was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Yes, it would have to be Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights. It's a rollicking love story, isn't it? And it's also quite gothic and ghostly. So, yeah, I still love that book. I think it's one of my favourite books, and I think I came across it in my early teens.
I have just returned from a visit to my landlord, the solitary neighbour that I shall be troubled with. This is certainly a beautiful country. In all England, I do not believe that I could have fixed on a situation so completely removed from the stir of society. A perfect misanthropist's heaven. And Mr. Heathcliff and I are such a suitable pair to divide the desolation between us. A capital fellow. He little imagined how my heart warmed towards him when I beheld his black eyes withdraw so suspiciously under their brows as I rode up, and when his fingers sheltered themselves with a jealous resolution still further in his waistcoat as I announced my name. "Mr. Heathcliff," I said. A nod was the answer. "Mr. Lockwood, your new tenant, sir. I do myself the honour of calling as soon as possible after my arrival, to express the hope that I have not inconvenienced you by my perseverance in soliciting the occupation of Thrushcross Grange. I heard yesterday you had had some thoughts—" "Thrushcross Grange is my own, sir," he interrupted, wincing.
Michael Kitchen, narrating Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte, which is available from the RNIB Library. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
I would love to reread Ingenious Pain by Andrew Miller, which must be now published over a decade ago. And again, I read it in my early stages of emerging as a writer, and I remember thinking how wonderful Miller is. It's a story set in the 18th century about a young man who cannot feel pain, and it sort of tracks his fortunes and misfortunes. Andrew Miller's one of the best living English writers we have, and he's an absolute wordsmith and writes beautifully. And it's one of those books you can just lose yourself in for days. And I still remember it. I want to reread it. So that would be my curl up on a rainy day book.
On a hot, cloud-hemmed afternoon in August, three men cross a stable yard near the village of Cow in Devon. The grouping is oddly formal. The two younger men, like heralds or warders, solemnly precede their host, or, more fancifully, draw him on. His black-coated bulk, his red face, by the reins of an invisible harness. One of the guests carries in his hand a leather bag from which, as he walks to the stable door, there comes a muffled jangling. It is the older man who, after a pause, opens the door, standing back for the others to enter. They do so, slowly against the darkness. The stable has been swept clean. The smell of horses, hay, of leather and dung is mixed with the smell of burnt lavender. Despite the season, there is no offensive odour from the corpse. The Reverend wonders if Mary knows the secrets of preserving flesh. In old days, the gods kept dead heroes sweet until the funeral games were done, the pyres lit. There are ways, no doubt, still. Ointments, spells, certain prayers.
John Sackville, narrating Ingenious Pain by Andrew Miller, which is available commercially. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Yes, it's by a friend of mine, Joanna Pocock, and it's called Surrender. And it's a book about the American Midwest. It's published by Fitzcarraldo Editions. And it's a memoir, and it's a book about America, about ecology. We meet people I've never met before, people living on the land, foragers, wild people. She goes on a buffalo hunt. It's a really contemporary feminist book written by a woman who's a mum coming through menopause. It's a book for our time. It's a great book, and it's had loads of critical acclaim and is selling all over the place.
Unfortunately, Surrender by Joanna Pocock isn't yet available in audio, but is available commercially in print. Monique Roffey, thank you so much for sharing your love of reading with the listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
The Mermaid of Black Conch by Monique Roffey is available in print, ebook, and audio wherever you buy your books. This is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Still to come, the short story of the Oscar-winning film Brokeback Mountain. But before that, with so many parents and children working and studying from home, it can be difficult to find room for downtime. But here's something for younger listeners and their families that's both fun and educational. Robert Kirkwood recalls the day a magical storyteller visited the RNIB Talking Book Studios to sprinkle some fairy dust.
One problem that arises when making audio versions of children's books is what to do about the illustrations. It's something Robert Kirkwood was keen to discover when Julia Donaldson came to the RNIB Studios.
Julia Donaldson paid a visit to the Talking Book Studios to record for us her book Freddy and the Fairy. And I was with her every step of the way.
Hello, I'm Julia Donaldson, and I'm going to read Freddy and the Fairy. I just got here on the train, and after I had a piece of toast and a cup of tea for breakfast. Is that all right?
That's fine. That sounds awful nice, actually.
Freddy and the Fairy by Julia Donaldson. This book is produced by RNIB. Freddy found a fairy tangled in a tree. "Help! I'm stuck!" the fairy cried. So Freddy set her free. "Thank you!"
As with all talking books, especially children's books where characterisation is perhaps more important, there was debate over the characters' voices.
"Yeah, I'm quite pleased with that. The only thing I find a bit difficult is Freddy's voice. You know, I think I'm doing Freddy's voice. I mean, I don't want him to be too unpleasant. You know, he is a bit of a brat, quite, I suppose. You know, he's. Let me just think. I wish I had a pet. I'd rather have a dog. Do you think something a bit more like that? Uh-huh. A little rather than I wish I had.
Yeah, maybe that's a bit deep.
A little bit, think, not quite so deep.
My name is Bessie Bell. I'll grant you all your wishes, though I can't hear very well. Freddy thought, then mumbled, I wish I had a pet. Why, so you shall, said Bessie Bell, and conjured up a net.
Freddy and the Fairy is being recorded for blind and partially sighted listeners, but the book itself is actually about hearing problems. Julia explains more.
It's actually a book about a deaf fairy. I'm a bit deaf myself. And I had this idea ages ago of a fairy just muddling up wishes. I thought that'd be quite funny. And a little boy wishing, say, for a dog and getting something totally different. Or originally I was going to have the fairy just mixing up different people's wishes. And then actually one of my sons said to me, Mum, why don't you make the fairy deaf, and then she could just mishear the wishes. So when the fairy, when the boy wishes for a dog, he gets a frog. When he wishes for a cat, he gets a bat, and so on. But the story's got a moral, because it turns out that the little boy's mumbling, and he's covering up his mouth. He's not looking at the fairy. And once he's learnt how to talk clearly, then all his wishes start to come true.
A problem arose as we got to the end of the book.
The very ending of the book shows just in the pictures that Freddy is wishing for a caterpillar, and the fairy, probably just mischievously by this stage, she gives him a gorilla and said she pretends she hasn't heard, and he gets a gorilla, and that's just quite a funny picture. But it's just shown in the book in thought bubbles. So I thought, well, how can I do this? How can I get this over with in a, just a purely audio version?
A number of solutions as to how to convey the ending were discussed, including an audio description of the pictures.
The only trouble with that for this book is because it's such a right... Well, yeah, in a way, it's the only instance.
It's just the one at the end.
And also because it's a rhyming... You know, I wouldn't want... You know, if it's not a rhyming book, then that'd be fine. Like, you do get books. I saw a book once which is about an imaginary friend. And it says, you know, every time... Jane went to the park, Mr. Monkey came too, and you just see, there's just a picture of Jane going to the park, you know, and then it says, you know, when Jane went to school, Mr. Monkey sat in the seat next to her, and you can't see, and you sort of realise that Mr. Monkey is an imaginary friend, but if you couldn't see, you would imagine that Mr. Monkey was... Yeah. In the pictures, and you wouldn't, you know, so then you would need someone to explain. Though that would be the way to do it. Another voice just at the end said, hold on, and everything he wishes for comes true. I wish I had a caterpillar. Or very nearly. He's got a gorilla. So Freddie learnt the three gold rules, and now he speaks quite clearly. And everything he wishes for comes true. Oh, oh, meow, meow, oh, oh. I wish I had a caterpillar. Or very nearly. Oh, no, I've got a gorilla. I don't know if that would work like that. And it, of course, you could just say at the end, in the pictures in the book, Freddie was wishing for a caterpillar. He ended up getting a gorilla. And I thought that, well, I just didn't think that would be that great. And so I actually sat down in this building building with the recording studios, and I wrote an extra verse saying you know, I can't remember off the heart, but I've written a special extra verse for this audio recording.
Now, Freddie, said the Fairy Queen. She sounded kind but stern. Before you wish again, there are three rules for you to learn. Rule one, you mustn't mumble. Rule two, don't turn away. The fairy needs to see your lips to read the words you say. Rule three, don't cover up your mouth. She can't see through your hand. Obey these three gold rules, and then I'm sure she'll understand. So, Freddie learnt the three gold rules, and now he speaks quite clearly, and everything he wishes for comes true, or very nearly. A dog, a cat, a bird, a mouse. What next? A caterpillar? The fairy laughed and conjured up a super-sized gorilla.
When we had finished recording all the audio for the book, Julia joined me for a chat, and I asked her about the start of her writing career.
Well, and I don't know if you want me to go right back to when I was at school, because I just always loved writing, really, from the time I learnt physically to write. And I do remember when I was at primary school, and I must have only been about five, and I wrote a story about a rabbit who was running away from a farmer and hid behind this shop counter, but his ears were poking up, and the farmer saw his ears and thought they were his ears, but the shopkeeper said, oh no, that's two carrots. And so even at the age of five, I was writing stories about trickster animals.
And I believe your first book, A Squash and a Squeeze, actually came from a song that was written for TV.
That's right, because, I wrote songs really for about 20 years before I wrote books. I used to write lots of songs for programmes like Play School, Play Days, Play Away. And A Squash and a Squeeze was a song I wrote based on an old Jewish folk tale. And it was done on television. And many years later, I got this phone call out of the blue from a publisher saying, could they use the words of that song as a picture book? So that's how I got started and in books.
What sort of songs were you asked to write then?
All sorts of really strange things. I mean, they would phone me up. They always seemed to want two songs, you know, which was quite good fun, actually, because when you got as far as you could with one, you'd go over to the other and you'd be sort of juggling them around. So, like, one time they said, could I write one song about silly slippers and another song about crumpling up bits of wrapping paper and throwing them into the bin? So I never turned anything down.
Now, with your picture books, how does the process work? Are you and, say, Axel Schaefer, who illustrated The Gruffalo, are you in the same room? Or are you?
No, not at all. I mean, he doesn't really even know whether I'm writing a new book, what it would be about. So I write completely on my own, and I don't even send the text to Axel. I'll send it to my editor, and she's the intermediary, she's the go-between. And then when Axel's doing the pictures, I'm not breathing down his neck either. You know, it's quite a separate process.
Do you ever get the illustrations back and think, that's not how I pictured him?
Well, of course, it's not going to be how you picture it. I think it's a bit like when you go on a holiday, you probably think, oh, Menorca's going to be like this, or, you know, Africa's, the safari park's going to be like that. And when you get there, it's never exactly as you've imagined it. But before long, you adjust to what you've actually got. So it's the same, really, with the illustrations.
Now, you're famous for your picture books, but you've also written books for older people, the Giants and the Joneses, and even older with Running on the Cracks. Will you ever write an adult novel?
If I did, I'd love to do something like Ruth Rendell. I really admire the crime writer Ruth Rendell, but especially her more psychological novels. I'd love to do something like that, but I don't really think I'm quite observant enough. A lot of my books are really quite fable-like, and it's difficult to explain, but anyway, it's very difficult to clear the decks as well. I just have such a busy life. That's my excuse anyway. It's so important for books to be available in audio. Children start off, before they can read, don't they? They start off hearing stories, hearing their parents telling stories. And I see audiobooks as being a wonderful continuation of that tradition. I was really shocked when I read that only a quite small percentage of the total number of books that there are available for blind people. And of course, when you want to write a book, you want everyone to get it. You're not trying to write for just the sighted section of the population. I think it's absolutely vital that people who are blind can get the stories.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thanks to Robert and to Julia Donaldson. A wide selection of her wonderful books is available in a range of formats from the RNIB library, including The Gruffalo, Room on the Broom, and of course that exclusive version of Freddy and the Fairy.
Now, before we share the books of CJ Skews' life, as part of LGBTQ+ History Month throughout February, we're highlighting the contribution of the LGBTQ+ community in society and writing. Brokeback Mountain is one of the most iconic gay films in history, and I wanted to find out more about the short story behind that film.
Over the years, more than a few authors have sought to distance themselves from the screen adaptations of their books. Truman Capote said that Audrey Hepburn's portrayal of Holly Golightly made him want to throw up. Stephen King loathed what Kubrick did to The Shining. And Roald Dahl didn't have a good word to say about any of the movies of his books, least of all Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. In many cases, the author is right. The book is better than the film it spawns. Even the most skilled filmmaker can't condense a 300-page book into a 90-minute movie without making some major sacrifices. Maybe that's why some of the best adaptations come from short stories or novellas. Today's Educating Red is a case in point. When author Annie Proulx first saw the 2005 film of her 64-page short story, Brokeback Mountain, she confessed she was so happy she was knocked into a loop. Despite being filmed in the Canadian Rockies for the most part, rather than Wyoming, where she set it, Prue has praised the faithfulness of the adaptation, saying, "I may be the first writer in America to have a piece of writing make it to the screen, whole and entire." Ang Lee's movie went on to win 3 Oscars, including that for Best Adapted Screenplay. And certainly when I came to read it recently, years after first watching the film, I immediately recognised the emotional power and poignancy I'd so loved in the film. The story is one of 11 contained in a collection of Prue's short fiction called Close Range, Wyoming Stories. In case you're not familiar with it, Brokeback Mountain follows Ennis and Jack, 2 young cowboys who meet in the summer of 1963. They're thrown together in the lonely wilderness of the Wyoming mountains and form an intense relationship.
"Too late to go out to them damn sheep," said Ennis, dizzy drunk on all fours, one cold hour when the moon had notched past 2. The meadow stones glowed white-green, and a flinty wind worked over the meadow, scraped the fire low, then ruffled it into yellow silk sashes. "Got you an extra blanket, I'll roll up out here and grab 40 winks. Ride out at first light. Freeze your ass off when that fire dies down. Better off sleeping in the tent. Doubt I'll feel nothing." But he staggered under canvas, pulled his boots off, snored on the groundcloth for a while, woke Jack with the clacking of his jaw. "Jesus Christ, quit hammering and get over here. Bedroll's big enough," said Jack in an irritable, sleep-clogged voice. It was big enough, warm enough.
The tale of their love for each other and the fear and hatred it arouses in themselves and in others is both brutal and beautiful.
What Jack remembered and craved in a way he could neither help nor understand was the time that distant summer on Brokeback, when Ennis had come up behind him and pulled him close, the silent embrace satisfying some shared and sexless hunger. They had stood that way for a long time in front of the fire, its burning tossing ruddy chunks of light, the shadow of their bodies a single column against the rock. The minutes ticked by from the round watch in Ennis's pocket, from the sticks in the fire settling into coals. Stars bit through the wavy heat layers above the fire. Ennis's breath came slow and quiet. He hummed, rocked a little in the sparklight, and Jack leaned against the steady heartbeat, the vibrations of the humming like faint electricity, and, standing, he fell into sleep that was not sleep.
Like all the stories in Close Range, the vast and desolate landscape of Wyoming looms over the characters and makes their struggle for survival against elements greater than themselves seem puny and doomed. A perfect backdrop for tragic heroism. Prue refuses to back away from the harshness and violence of small-town American rural life, and her empathy makes that struggle something we can all identify with. Close Range was recommended to me by an American friend in the wake of the US presidential election. "You've got to understand the context," he told me. "A lot of folks just want hope. It doesn't matter who's giving it or whether it's real. Like Annie Prue writes, people in hell just want a drink of water." That's the title of one of her best short stories, and in many ways sums them all up.
"Well, see you around, I guess."
The wind tumbled an empty feed bag down the street, till it fetched up under his truck.
"Right," said Jack, and they shook hands, hit each other on the shoulder. Then there was 40 feet of distance between them, and nothing to do but drive away in opposite directions. Within a mile, Ennis felt like someone was pulling his guts out hand over hand a yard at a time. He stopped at the side of the road and, in the whirling new snow, tried to puke, but nothing came up. He felt about as bad as he ever had, and it took a long time for the feeling to wear off.
Years ago, after enjoying the film, I borrowed a copy of the book, only to abandon it after the first story, The Half-Skinned Steer. And there's no doubt that one will put some readers off. But this time I read on, and I came to see what my friend meant. These are stories from the margins of society. Life is tough and dependent on fickle forces over which people have no control. As one farmer puts it, reality's never been much use out here, but hope is everything. I'm glad I persevered with it. The stories it contains are genuinely moving and made me consider life in a context I am grateful is not my own.
He was a friend of mine. He was a friend of mine.
Annie Proulx's Close Range is in the RNIB Library, TB number 15355. And you can also find her Pulitzer Prize winning novel, The Shipping News, TB number 15748.
Was a friend of mine.
Now it's back to CJ Skews for the books of her life. So CJ, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Well, I'm going to cheat a little bit for this one, because the book or books that always stick in my mind when I'm asked this question are the Beatrix Potter books. And I remember when I was about 8, I got given for Christmas the entire Beatrix Potter compendium. And I was under pain of death to keep all of the books in their little sleeves and to keep them immaculate. And I've still got the box now, and it's absolutely immaculate all these decades later. And those were the books really that started my love of reading, because they are just such perfect little stories. And it's great to read them now and look at how real Beatrix Potter made the world for children. She didn't sugarcoat sometimes the trauma that can come in real life, unexpected death and, you know, nature on nature. And Jemima Puddle Duck just sticks in my head for the fact that she kind of berates Jemima for leaving her eggs unattended so they get eaten by the fox. And then she, you know, the eggs don't come back to life in the end. She loses her eggs. And it was very much part of Beatrix's, because I've read a biography that she did a few years ago, or somebody did of her, where she just didn't sugarcoat the world for children. And I really respect her for that. And the illustrations are just absolutely stunning. The fact that she illustrated them herself as well, they really inspired me as a child to write my own books. And also, they're just lovely little short stories. And I love reading short stories now as well. So they were definitely the start. They lit the spark of my love of books.
What a funny sight it is to see a brood of ducklings with a hen. Listen to the story of Jemima Puddle Duck, who was annoyed because the farmer's wife would not let her hatch her own eggs. Her sister-in-law, Mrs. Rebecca Puddle Duck, was perfectly willing to leave the hatching to someone else. "I have not the patience to sit on a nest for 28 days, and no more have you, Jemima. You would let them go cold, you know you would." "I wish to hatch my own eggs. I will hatch them all by myself," quacked Jemima Puddle Duck.
Diana Bishop, rating The Complete Tales by Beatrix Potter, which is available from the RNIB Library. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
It's another children's book, believe it or not. It's The Wind in the Willows by Kenneth Graham. I have an illustrated version of the book, which I keep absolutely immaculate. And if I'm feeling a bit low, or if it's a really miserable day and I haven't got anything else to do, I will curl up and look at this book. It's just so cozy and lovely. And I feel very much like Moll, because, you know, I've got my little house and I like spring cleaning it and I like my safe little world. And sometimes I'm scared to go out into the wild world and the wide wood. And I'm scared of what's beyond the walls sometimes. And I need somebody like Ratty every now and again to come into my life and just take me by the hand and say, look, it's actually okay. If you stay away from these areas and these people, it's not a bad place. So I've got a great affinity for Moll in the book. So yeah, The Wind in the Willows, I'm a big fan of that book and that author. I did a bit of a literary pilgrimage a few years ago to Kenneth Graham's birthplace and where he grew up in Scotland, and I read the Alison Prince biography in Innocent in the Wild Wood, which I would really recommend as well as another book for you. It just talks about the fact that he was a frustrated child in later life, how he never grew up, part of him never grew up in his own mind. And that was born out of a traumatic childhood as well. So there's an overlap there with Rhiannon, I think.
"Ready," said the mole suddenly, one bright summer morning. "If you please, I want to ask you a favour. Won't you take me to call on Mr. Toad? I've heard so much about him, and I do so want to make his acquaintance.
Why, certainly, said the good-natured rat. Get the boat out, and we'll paddle up there at once. It's never the wrong time to call on Toad. Early or late, he's always the same fellow. Always good-tempered, always glad to see you, always sorry when you go.
He must be a very nice animal, observed the mole, as he got into the boat and took the sculls, while the rat settled himself comfortably in the stern.
He is indeed the best of animals, replied Rat. So simple, so good-natured, and so affectionate. Perhaps he's not very clever, we can't all be geniuses, and it may be that he is both boastful and conceited, but he has got some great qualities, has Toady.
Rounding a bend in the river, they came in sight of a handsome, dignified old house of mellowed red brick, with well-kept lawns reaching down to the water's edge.
There's Toad Hall, said the Rat, and that creek on the left, where the notice board says, Private, no landing allowed, leads to his boathouse, where we leave the boat. The stables are over there to the right. That's the banqueting hall you're looking at now. Very old, that is. Toad is rather rich, you know, and this is really one of the nicest houses in these parts, though we never admit as much to Toad.
The evergreen Richard Briers narrating The Wind in the Willows by Kenneth Graham, which is available from the RNIB Library. And finally, is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
There's a book I have read recently by an ex-student of mine called Sarah Milano, and Sarah is spelled S-E-R-A, and it's called This Can Never Not Be Real. It's being published in March, so it might not be available for your listeners yet. And it's about a terrorist attack. It's quite dark and it's quite harrowing in places, but the ultimate message is one of hope and community, and it doesn't celebrate the violence at all. It's a terrorist attack that happens at a rural festival, and I mean, it's horribly real the way it's written, but ultimately the strong message is one of, you know, we can overcome this. Once we've processed it, we can come together, and we know who the baddies are, we know who the good guys are. But it's very, very powerful and very well written. And as I say, Sarah was an old student of mine on the MA in writing for young people at Bath Spa, and she just keeps getting better and better. So I would recommend that one.
As CJ says, This Can Never Not Be Real by Sarah Milano has yet to be published, but it certainly sounds like one to listen out for. Well, CJ Skews, thank you so much for sharing your obvious love of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today, but Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at RedSail, which is RedSzell, and Robert Kirkwood is at Talking_Books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.